Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
We're on our way to doing something great.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 153, a talk with Chris Calico. Chris initially became known to hip-hop fans in the early 2000s as the ever-present hook man and onstage foil to Tech N9ne. He quickly branched out into working with pretty much every artist on Tech's label Strange Music, lacing tracks with both his singing and his rapping. His solo career would begin in 2008 with the album Vitiligo, and each record after that would reveal a diverse musical personality, equally comfortable with double-time raps, R&B hooks, and even Sinatra-style crooning. Chris's latest album, released this past April, is called Go. We met up with Chris at his hotel in Midtown Manhattan. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with some other key Strange Music players, Recognize and Burns of the group Mayday, on episode 93. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a fraction of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making this show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the genius, Chris Calico.
There was kind of this whole phase where you and Tech were doing interviews together.
I don't know if it was just
because you were on tour or what was.
We do though. We generally, if he's around or if he was here with us, he would come in here right now.
Yeah.
We always do interviews together. Yeah. It's always more interesting though, because our banter, our back and forth is like, it seems like it's staged, but it's not. It's always hilarious.
We've been working on all these years and we're actually good enough to do any kind of festival or TV show.
It's Illuminati, actually. I'll be the first to say it. Illuminati helped us. We don't have any talent. We've never worked a day in our life.
Nice. So and yeah. So you got quite an art form of that after after so long.
Yes, man.
So you know, I was thinking about the beginnings of your career with Strange Music, and I know you met Tech. You know, late 90s in that session for, what was it, Who You Came to See? I think the song that ended up being Who You Came to See.
Yeah.
Tell me who you came to see.
Tech N9ne,
y'all. Been on TV, been on CDs. Who been that mystery? What's my name?
Tech N9ne,
what you came for me?
That obviously wasn't the very first time you made music. What did like a pre-Strange Music Chris Calico sound like?
Well, you know, I originally came from the church, man, from the Baptist church. You know, that's where I learned how to do music. And, you know, and I performed in talent shows, man, at school. And I've been performing and singing since I was probably 8 years old, you know. And I didn't even want to do music. My mother kind of forced it on me. You know, she would be like, sing this note, and didn't have me singing in church choir. And, you know, our family, when I was a kid, we were in church, you know, 3 days a week. And three, 4 days a week, you know what I mean? And so, you know, as I got older, of course, you know, I was primarily just singing, you know. I rapped just because I could, you know, and so I would rap just playing around in school. You know, we would have these things where, you know, we were ribbing each other on the school bus. You know, I would rap. I would, back then, there wasn't freestyle battling, but that's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I'd be rapping and, you know, and what they call cracking on these dudes, you know. But then, you know, of course, all of that went into me just singing. And so the pre-Strange Music would have been just R&B music. And then I hired Tech N9ne to get on a song with me because I decided I was going to do music. I was going to do an album. And he thought I was going to be singing, and I was actually rapping the verse. And he was like, whoa, you made me have to rethink my verse, dude. You know, and he's like, nobody's ever made me do that.
We checked with Chris after the interview to see if he had a copy of this song. He told us both that he doesn't and that it was called Deception and Lies. After some intense searching, it seems that this song has indeed been lost to the ages.
And then from there, I started helping him with his singers. And then I became like the staple hook or chorus guy at Strange Music. And that's how I got in.
Yeah. But there was this long period during that. So you know, your first song, that first song with Tech got released, I think, 01.
Tech N9ne's Who You Came to See from the 2001 album Angelic.
Yeah.
But then your first solo album didn't come out until 08. Were
right.
you ever sort of chomping at the bit during that
yes.
period? Was there ever any tension around let me release my solo record?
Yeah, absolutely it was. I was like, man, I wasn't signed. You know, I was just riding because Tech and Trav and the other guys that were with us were my, you know, we formed this brotherhood. And, you know, we weren't making any money at the time. I was working a regular job. I worked at T-Mobile at the time. It was VoiceStream at that time.
Mm.
And, yeah, man. And then I lost my job because we were doing gigs. And I was like, dude, we're going to have to start making some money. So we were doing gigs for free then, just trying to get people to, you know, just let us in. We performed at any whatever, restaurant, campfire, whatever. Too, but I remember performing at like Mexican restaurants, you know, all up the West Coast, and they would have
with you and Tech,
and they would have like a Taco Tuesday, and we knew that it was going to be a lot of people there, so we would show up on the Taco Tuesday and perform, man, and that's how we formed it, man, just going from town to town to town to town,
mm-hmm.
doing it. So yeah, until we didn't sign that deal, I didn't sign a deal until in 08, right before I dropped Vitiligo, my first album.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. One of the things I think Tech liked about you was that you were able to come up with hooks really quickly.
Yeah.
How do you get good at something like that? It's such like unique skill. It's not songwriting exactly.
Well, it is songwriting, but it was just, man, I've always been a really quick-witted man. You know, I always have like quick comebacks and, you know, I think where that really originates from is not even music. You know, having vitiligo and looking different than everybody else and being a chubby kid, you know, I had to have these quick comebacks to defend myself. So my wit has been quick since I was a kid. Like even now, like I'm a jokester. My mother always aspired for me to be a stand-up comedian, you know, but, you know, so I always had a quick wit. So I just, you know, it kind of used that same skill set in music. So he would have, and then it was kind of out of desperation. Because I really wanted to be down with Strange Music. So, you know, he would have, you know, at the time, Cut Calhoun and Grant Rice were two dudes on stage with him. And he'd have them around. And, you know, they would all be trying to think of hooks. And I thought, oh, I had to beat them to the punch. So, oh, yeah, let's do this. Oh, no, I got a hook for that. And then sometimes I would even memorize whatever beat he's playing. And I would hum it. So I would hum it on my way home. By the time he went to the studio, I'd have a hook written for it.
Wow. So it was self-preservation as much as anything else.
Yeah, I need them publishing checks, man. I want that publishing. But then Tech and I just have always had this, you know, just ridiculous chemistry. And, you know, I became like what people will say the Nate Dogg of Strange Music. Because Nate Dogg always did the hooks with, you know. The Dre camp, you know, Aftermath camp or whatever you want to call it. You know, so yeah, man, I got in where I could fit in, man, and here we are today.
Wow. So taking it back a little earlier, when you were about 15, you had a couple big things happen all in a row, right? Your father passed away and then you moved from like sort of a predominantly Jewish suburb into the inner city.
Right.
What was it like going through those huge changes at basically the same time?
I mean, it's traumatic. You know, it's part of the reason why, you know... All these traumatic things that happen are probably why I kind of have had these bouts with anxiety and things like that. You know, it was good and bad, man, because it enabled me to have a very diverse upbringing. Because when you grow up in a neighborhood, my neighborhood proper was really diverse. But where I went to school at, in that neighborhood was all of the Jewish kids, you know, and that's kind of who I hung with, you know, so... Which is so funny because half of these kids I went to school with are like rabbis now. So funny. But then we moved into the inner city. But where we moved into the inner city was an upper middle class black area called Citadel Homes. And my sister actually put the down payment on the house for my mother because my sister was hit by a drunk driver that year. And her boyfriend's mother and brother were killed in the car wreck when she got a settlement. And so she, you know, essentially bought my mother a home with it and a car. And then my dad died. So I had a trust fund. Well, she bought my mom a house and then I bought my mother a car. And, but it was, you know, even though we had money from trust fund and from settlements and stuff, you know, it was super traumatic that year, losing my father, almost losing my sister in the wreck. And, you know, so it took me through all these twists and turns. Now, when I got down in the inner city, even though it was an upper middle class black area, it was surrounded by the hood. So everything the hood had to offer, I jumped in. You know what I'm saying? I actually got into, you know, that whole area was like a blood gang area. I also worked at a store in the hood down on 31st Street, which is deep in the hood of Kansas City, where there was drive-by shootings in front of the stores.
Happy Foods?
Happy Foods, man. Happy Foods.
It does not sound like a happy place from how you've described
it. It should have been called Unhappy Foods. It definitely was. It definitely had drive-bys like weekly. You know, I had a, it's funny, man, cause I tell people I was in church 3 days a week. I was trying to sell dope and I was going to college. It's like
three jobs.
How does that happen? And I'm living in the hood and all my friends are like rich Jewish kids. It's like, it's like the most diverse background you can have, man. But it, you know, it's what you see today. This is why I can do all these different genres of music, because I had all these different cultures that I was immersed in, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so, you know, you spent, like you said, till you were 15 in a primarily Jewish suburb. And
Yeah.
To what extent did you experience any kind of racial prejudice while you were there?
Oh, I did a lot. I mean, I you know, I was a fairly popular kid, but I got teased a lot, bullied a lot. But then I also was popular, too, because I danced and sang and I was one of very few black kids there. You know, so I had kids teasing me about let alone I was one of the few black kids, and then I had vitiligo on my face, too. You know, so I got all of these names. I was called Zebra and Black and Decker and just all of these names I can think of that these kids, you know, called me, you know. And, you know, my sister, it's funny, she kind of blended. I guess I blended with them, but she was what people would be considered we consider her an Oreo. They used to call her an Oreo because she talked white is what they would say. But it was really just her talking proper. You know, with me, I was trying to run down to the hood. I was trying to figure, like, I felt like as I got older, like, okay, I don't really fit in here. Let me go down here where the hood is. And, you know, this is what they do down here. Okay, I'm going to try to sell weed. All right, I'm going to try to sell crack. All right, I'm going to try to, you know, and it wasn't for me. It was not for me. And I was scared the whole time I was trying to do this. Because I came from educated parents. My father had a doctorate in arithmetic and was an educator and owned his own business. My mother had a master's degree in education. It was, you know what I'm saying? So I came from like a good upbringing, really, you know, but I didn't want that. I wanted to see what the hood had. I felt like I should be identifying with that. But now that I've gotten older, I don't want any parts of that. I'm cool.
Yeah. You've mentioned a few times, you know, your vitiligo. Obviously, you named your first album after it.
Yeah. Because what I'm going to do, I'm going to tattoo my face and erase this. This is vitiligo. What kind of life is that for a boy who looks like this? What interference?
Your mother's reaction to it, I think, is so interesting, and you kind of hinted at this. She always said, if I'm correct, that you were going to be a performer. Mm-hmm. And that you could use that as a gimmick.
Yeah.
She was sort of hammering that into you from day one.
She did.
What was your reaction to that at the time? And when did you kind of come to realize, hey, there might be something there. Maybe she was right.
Probably around 1999, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, wow, she's right. And I actually have. I didn't use it as a gimmick, really. But, naturally, I have the vitiligo. And that's why I called myself Calico, like the cat.
Mm.
And so I did actually kind of use it. You know, she said that I was going to be, she said, you're going to be something big. And, you know, a lot of people I went to school with always thought that too, because I remember as a young dude having I remember having like a beaded jacket and being like this celebrity at school just for having a beaded jacket. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, I always knew I was going to be something. I didn't know what it was going to be. Because Kansas City is not a big hub for entertainment. Now, it is, you know, for jazz and things like that. But it's not a big hub for entertainers that you know that get famous. So I didn't think that was going to be my job. But I knew I was going to do something big. But I went to college and I dropped out. I was like, this is not for me. I thought I was going to be an attorney. And I'm like, no, that's, I don't want to do that. That's boring.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Beat It jacket. Obviously, you know, you are the second most famous person with Vitiligo.
Yeah, man.
What kind of connection did you feel to Michael Jackson after that, his condition became public?
Man, I've always felt a crazy connection to Michael Jackson, like my whole life. I never really talked about that before, but I do. I was just watching, accidentally watching a show, Autopsy, the other day. And they were showing like all of this stuff that led up to Michael Jackson's death. And even a lot of the things that he did, the ways that he felt, the drugs that he's taken, I identify with all of that. All of the medications that they were saying he was on at the time of his death, I've been on all of those medications. Now, he was on all of them at once.
Right.
I've been on all of those at different times, from propofol to Depakote to all of these different anti-anxiety medications and things like that, man. But I've always identified with him for some reason, man. I don't know what it is. And then when he came out and he said he had vitiligo, I'm like, wow. But I've been saying that since I was a kid, that I had this weird connection and weird way to relating to Michael Jackson, man. Even up until my video that I have right now, Talk Upon It.
I'm just trying to talk upon it. Okay.
The comments are like, man, this reminds me of a Michael Jackson video. And actually, that's where I got the idea from, the way you make me feel.
Mm-hmm.
The way you make me feel, he was trying to get this girl and he was dancing all around her. But I didn't really do it. It wasn't like his, but that was like where I got the influence, and with the dancing and stuff.
Right, right. And I know from seeing you in other interviews that you know the Thriller dance.
Listen, man, the first move of the routine is just a shoulder pop. You don't know that?
Oh, shit, you damn right. No, I thought it was this one right here.
That's like 12 moves in.
Oh, it is 12 moves in.
I do know the Thriller dance. We used to do it on stage. We used to do break down and do Thriller in the middle of our show, me and Tech and Cut Calhoun.
Amazing. So someone else, you know, famous who I know you felt a connection to, even though I don't think you knew him personally, was Robin Williams. After he passed, when stuff kind of came out that maybe he had some mental health issues.
Freaked me out, dude. Freaked me out. When he committed suicide, I don't know why I got scared about myself. And I always been a fan of Robin Williams. And I always wondered, man, I'm like, his brain's got to be to the left, because people who are really creative have this to the left brain. But he was so like, his jokes were so random, and it seemed like his brain was so all over the place.
I don't know whether to have the red one with the fish or the chicken. What's the matter, asshole? They're dead. The chicken's not going to reach up from the plate and go, the red wine. It's over with. No, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not talking about Pui-Fusse or Pussy-Fusse. Uh-uh. I'm talking about Mad Dog 2020. You know, the very elegant wine, the type of wine with a lovely screw top, a bottle of which after you can actually see vapor trails as people pass you. How you doing?
I always wondered if he went through stuff as I got older and I started experiencing things. But yeah, man, when that happened to Robin, man, I was like, I got super scared for myself. Like, that's when I started actually looking for therapy.
Wow.
I was worried about myself then. But, you know, I think he had some other things going on too, some other health issues, which they said he had Parkinson's is what I heard. And, you know, like I was just saying, you know, I say it in interviews all the time, man. A lot of times I think people don't feel like they have a way out of that, because I felt like that before. Like, there's no way out of this. I don't have, and I still feel like it from time to time. There's no way out of this except to escape the world. But, you know, everything is seasonal. Everything's seasonal. I mean, it doesn't even stay winter forever. It doesn't stay summer. It doesn't stay hot forever. Those times will change, you know, and it's hard to tell yourself that. You have to just keep telling yourself that. Otherwise, end up hanging, you know, meaning your own demise. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
Yeah, I really identified with how he was, the ways that they said he was feeling, man. And I still think about it from time to time. Anytime I see a picture of him, I'm like, Jesus.
Yeah. Taking it back to the Vitiligo album, Anxiety is, you know, one of your most popular tunes.
Yeah.
I noticed that just for a second, a brief NWA homage in it, I think, to Parental Discretion Is Advised or something. Just like a little quote of it.
Where?
Psycho, like no other motherfucker, so step to me wrong. G.O. for what you in over. Psycho, might go, schizo, get your fix. Too many hits to make you slit your wrist.
No, no.
In one of the verses, no?
Oh, LL Cool J.
Who was LL?
The very first line, when I'm alone in my room,
sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call, telling me I need a girl who's as sweet as a dove. For the first time in my life, I see I need love. When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call, telling me I need a gun just in case of a brawl. I can block them all, shoot them up to them falls.
No, wasn't that...
No?
Well, I'll have to see if I can find it afterwards.
Maybe
there
it
was,
is.
There was something that had a rhythm from I think, good verse and Parental Discretion.
Oh, it could have been.
That
I don't know. Maybe.
All right. Well, I was going to say, since they got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, what do you remember about listening to NWA?
I remember being scared to death when I heard that. Like, oh, my God, man, how are they able to say this on record? How are they able to talk about, you know, F the police and doing drive-bys and jacking people for datings? Because right after that, I mean, that came out when I was a little kid, but I remember when I first got some datings.
Datings are wire rims.
I was like, man, I hope I don't get jacked. I got a gun and everything. Yeah, because I didn't want to get jacked for my dates. You know what I'm saying? As a kid, you do young, dumb stuff. Why would I just not get datings?
Right.
I was like, I'm going to get datings, and then I'm going to get a side of gun. you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, yeah.
But I remember, man, being really influenced by that, influenced by Ice Cube and that whole movement, man. That when I saw it, just to go see Straight Outta Compton, man, it was like, man, that really was nostalgic to me. You know what I mean? Because I remember some of that. I remember when those songs came out, and to see kind of the backstory on them, it was really great.
Yeah, and the Genius album. Speaking of sort of golden age classic rap, the intro to the Genius album has a little Midnight Marauders.
Hello, this is your Midnight Marauder program. I'm on the front of your cover. I will be enhancing your effect.
Thank you for choosing the Genius program. We hope you find our presentation precise and enjoyable. Think smart.
Aha! You're the first person to ever caught that, dude.
Oh, wow.
No one's ever caught that.
What did you think about Tribe, and kind of what did you feel when Fife passed?
Oh, man, I met them, man. I met them a couple of times. We did a couple of shows with them. We did Rock the Bells with them, too. And I actually only saw Q-Tip once, but I actually talked to Fife. We did a festival with them, I want to say in the Montreux Jazz Festival, which is in Switzerland. I think it's in Switzerland, yeah. And I remember talking to Fife. I remember seeing him and thinking he didn't look well then. And I think he was fighting with it back then. But I was a huge Tribe fan, man. That album in particular, Midnight Marauders, man. That's so crazy, man. No one's ever caught that. And that's actually my wife doing the voice.
Oh, really? Doing the robot voice.
Welcome to the Genius program, yeah. Yeah, I had her listen to that. And then we, you know, of course, chopped it up to make it sound like that. But
right,
yeah,
right, with all the weird pauses and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's awesome that you caught that.
Nice. And that record actually, you know, is a very rap record. You're rapping almost the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you have Choir Boy, which is essentially a full out gospel song.
Yeah.
Kick it with the King of Jews. Come on.
How did people react to that at the time?
People like it, man. I get these random references to Choir Boy where people are like, you know, plus I've called myself that on numerous occasions. So I get people talking about it. Choir Boy, or I've seen people tatting it on them. that have my logo and they have Choir Boy underneath it, like tatted on them. So I always did it, man, because I've always had a, you know, that's why my background is, you know, growing up, like I said, in a Baptist church, man. So I always sprinkle that into the music. And naturally, I can't, unless I'm going to market it to the gospel music world, I couldn't do a whole album like this. But I always sprinkled it in, man. And it's always been pretty well received, man. You know, I've always done a lot of genre hopping on my albums, man. And people seem to like it. You know, it's like they can put my album on and play it from start to finish and just clean the house or whatever. And you don't even have to change it because you're going to get a rock song and then a R&B song and then a whatever song.
And speaking of rock songs, you know, the Shock Treatment, the album that followed, there's a lot of like rock guitars on that record.
You try it, so
I don't know what you gave me. I don't want you to save me. I got to get you naked.
Feels like I could die inside you.
Was that kind of a conscious thing where you're like, I want more of a rock sound? Or
I did.
Yeah?
I did, man. I wanted more of a rock sound on that album. And I was using some, I wanted it to feel, a little pop rock-ish, and it was kind of dark too. It's like a dark rock pop album, which that's probably my least well-received album.
Do you think it has to do with that?
I don't know, but it didn't get, they didn't buy that album that much. The one after that, I think, did a lot better. Mm-hmm. I think my most popular album is Kicking and Screaming.
Right. With Shock Treatment, it's basically kind of all about partying.
Yeah.
Baby mama got them jeans so fitted. When the liquor hit me quicker and tell me to go get it. And I'm with it. Girl, you did that. I just can't park my car where you live at. Cause I really be liking them low life type mics.
Yeah. Every girl in the club got they sexy stripper dance, you know.
Uh-huh.
Your turn.
It's your song. When you turn it on, girl, dance real sexy like this. If it's your song.
What was going on in your life when you were writing it?
I don't know. Evidently, I was partying. I don't know, man. I evidently, my mood was up. Because when it's up, because I write my life. So if I'm kind of depressed, man, you're going to get that. But if I'm partying or if I'm having a good time and enjoying life at the time, then that's what you're going to get there, too.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one final song on that I want to talk about was Freaks,
yeah.
Where you sort of make a nod to acceptance from the Juggalos, from the Insane Clown Posse's
yeah,
audience.
Yeah, man.
Give them a reason to stare at Juggalos and Juggalettes again. We're taking note for when you let us in. And I'm supposed to take my back.
And I thought that was a little unusual. It was kind of cool that you took the time to shout them out on a song and say, you know, thank you for accepting us.
Yeah.
How did you first find out that you appealed to that crowd? And what do you think it is they liked about you?
I think it was really the music that I was doing with Tech, the dark sound and stuff, because that's what they like. Mm. They like the darker content in the music. And I didn't even know what that was. Like ICP hit us up to perform at their gathering of the Juggalos, and I was like, what in the world is a Juggalo? And we saw these kids, and they were kind of the outcasts of the world, and they loved it because we're kind of the outcasts of the world too. They adopted us as people they looked up to besides ICP. You know what that made people think is that our music was like ICP's, which it's not. It's like totally different, but we shared that fan base. And so I had to give it up to them, man, because they've been riding with us since 03.
Yeah.
And still, to yesterday, we were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and most of the crowd was Juggalos. You know, so we have these, you know, the thing about Strange Music is that, you know, you don't have to know about us. You don't have to even like rap to like us,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially with my new album because it's mostly singing. But, you know, before it was mostly hip hop based, and we would get a lot of people saying, hey, man, I'm a metalhead, but I love you guys. Or I'm a Juggalo and I love horrorcore, but I love your songs when you sing. You know what I'm saying? And things like that. So that's the beauty of us, man. We infect the masses, no matter what type of music you like.
So you mentioned your show, I think last night was in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Did you have any second thoughts about doing it? I know there's been a lot of performers have been canceling stuff in North Carolina recently. Bruce
really?
Springsteen just canceled his show there.
Why?
Because they passed a pretty awful sort of anti-transgender law.
Oh, that has nothing to do with me. I got to go get the check. My kids have to eat. So I got to go.
Yeah.
I had no idea about that.
Okay.
No second thoughts because we weren't even aware.
Mm.
But even if we were aware, man, we don't cancel concerts. There was a tornado. Our first show on this tour was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there was a tornado there, tornado warning, and we went right into it. It was like blocks away from where we were at. We don't cancel, man. I tell my mother, my mom's like, well, you guys better not go. I'm like, oh, no, Mom, we go. We don't miss, we love the fans, and and like I said, this is our living, man, so you got to go, dude. If we were going to die, which we almost have several times, we wouldn't go, but I guess we're stupid. I don't know.
Right. I want to ask about something about a couple of things about Son of Sam real quick before we get into Go.
Okay.
Which was, you know, you'd Send Your Love, that song, which is kind of like a goofy, like, homage to Computer Love.
Right.
Made me thinking, were you a Big Zap fan?
Big Zap fan.
Yeah.
Big Zap fan. I was trying to, you know, do that without actually sampling them and getting in trouble. But, you know, I made it different enough to where we wouldn't have to do that. But, yeah, man, I cried like a baby when Roger Troutman died. And I always loved that song. I always thought that song was like a huge hit that we didn't chase.
Yeah, definitely. It was great. And, you know, appropriately enough, since she's in the room right now, the song Schizophrenia actually uses your wife's real name. Does doing stuff like that, maybe revealing things that are personal? Yeah. At least her first name appears towards the end of the song. Am I reminiscing of beating up the kitty cats in a pit and pick my tongue off the floor? And I wish that Chris would walk out the
door to a pit and just about ready to go. But she kissed me. Now I can't leave for sure. You know. Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so man.
Does that personal stuff ever kind of get you in trouble with people in your real life?
People, meaning my wife, yeah. Because, man, sometimes I'm too transparent. But also, you know, what I do with the relationship songs, man, is like I'll sprinkle in stuff about me, but I usually use other people's relationships too. Because there's been things that I've said in songs with relationships where it wasn't my relationship necessarily. But I'll mix it all together. And people usually think, oh, wow, what a crazy relationship he must have. Because I'm talking about mine and whoever else is around me. Or if somebody tells me a story, I'll note it, you know?
Yeah. One of the craziest hooks you ever did was, that I've heard, was Welcome to the Midwest. That tech song where you do kind of your best Frank Sinatra crooner style thing. The club, get the skip because they tripping up in the mall. It doesn't really matter where you go, where you've been. Beautiful foreign lands you've been in. Gunplay rains, sun rays shine. Stay inside, you should be fine. I'll show you, follow me. Welcome to the Midwest. It's a city where anybody can call. How on earth did that happen?
Our CEO, man, Travis O'Gwen, man, he and I had an uncomfortable conversation. And I remember I was pissed. And I called Tech and I was talking to him about it. And I can say that now because we're actually really close and we have a great business relationship and a great friendship at this point, too. But I was really pissed at him. And I remember calling Tech and talking to him about it. And he said, man, just channel that energy, dude, into like a hook. Here, I got it. I'm writing Welcome to the Midwest, man. Matter of fact, you should rap on it and you should write the hook. And I just heard the music, the strings. And I called Tech and I said, hey, man, I got this idea. I called him back like 15 minutes later, like, what would you think if I wrote a song like Frank Sinatra and I sang it like, it doesn't really matter where you go, where you've been. Beautiful foreign lands you've been in. Gunplay rain, sun rays shine. stay inside, you will be fine. You know, I said it sounds beautiful, but what I'm saying is gangster for real. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm saying, like, doesn't matter how many beautiful places you go to, our city is like, the nickname for Kansas City is the KC. The hood nickname is Killer City because there's so many deaths there. You know what I'm saying? So many murders there. So what I'm saying is, like, really, I'm talking about that, but it just sounds pretty. You know what I'm saying? So he was like, dude, that's a great idea. We perform that every night right now. And the people love that. I could literally say, it doesn't really matter. And the whole crowd was singing the chorus.
All doing their best Frank Sinatra.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
It's great.
Yeah,
man. It's great. And, you know, many years ago, I saw Richie Havens perform.
Right.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
And so when I heard your hook on Speed-Em.
Yeah.
You know, it obviously brought me back to that. Was that your idea to interpolate Freedom?
Nah, that was Tex.
Really?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, man. Tex, he's like, hey, man, I think I want to make this. And he played it. And I was like, man, we're going to have to go after single rights. I mean, clearance on that. And he's like, yeah, I plan on it. And he played that Woodstock. I'd never even heard that before. You know, and he played it. And so it's funny because actually when we perform it live, I do it like Richie Havens. I say, clap your hands, clap your hands.
Clap your hands, clap your hands.
I actually start the song like that.
Wow.
You know, just like how he started it at Woodstock.
Yeah.
I was really moved by that performance. And I told him, he played it for me, and I just kind of deboed my way onto the song. I was like, I'm going to write that hook, dude. I'm writing that hook. And he was like, yeah, you should. And then I wrote it like right then. We were on the bus, and I came back, and I was like, man, what'd you think if I say, sometimes I feel like I'll never slow down? You know, he was like, man, that's perfect. And I was like, all right, now I already got half my verse, too.
And he was like, and you hadn't even talked about rapping on it yet.
No, and I rapped my verse, and I recorded it. I rapped and recorded. I mean, I recorded my verse and that hook and everything before him or Eminem got on that song.
I was going to ask about that, if you'd heard either of Tex's verses or M's verse.
They hadn't written them.
Wow.
Actually, I wrote that verse and then I lost it because I write everything in my phone. And I actually took that up to Canada. We went up to Canada and did a tour. And my wife and I were celebrating our anniversary. And we got in a hot tub, man. And I dipped my phone in the hot tub and lost that verse. But fortunately, I remembered like 12 bars of it. And I had to write a new the last four bars over. And once I wrote it, I mean, once I laid it, I went and listened to my verse of it popped back up. When I got back home, my iCloud, it just retrieved it on its own. And my last four bars weren't as good. The original four bars
weren't as good.
Yeah. So it was a blessing in disguise that I did that. And that song ended up being dope. And then Tech wrote his verse, and then Eminem got on. And that was crazy to see Eminem talking about and trying to quote my lyrics. That was crazy. Because I thought it was bigger for Tech, like, because he's been an Eminem fan for so long, and he really wanted to get an Eminem feature. And I was like, man, that's big for him. I mean, it's big for me, but it's really big for him because he's been wanting it. And I wasn't really tripping off of it until he said my name. When he did it, I was like, dang, I'm on a song with Eminem. That's dope. And then when he was on doing interviews and he was like, man, Chris Calico, and he was trying to like, he was like, man, it's one pattern he's got in there.
Chris has that man, it's like eight bars that are just like that. I'm damn, what is it? I'm to the top of the, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
Something feminine. And then it,
Yeah.
That shit is like, what the fuck? And reverse the reverse the conditions. I'm living in.
Do bigger numbers than
tipping the pen and reverse the conditions. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And he was talking about it. Set a purpose to pimp the pen and reverse conditions I'm living in and do bigger numbers than Eminem. I said that, and he was never slated to be on the song. I just was, I put his name in it. That just happened to be what I said. And when he was getting on, I was like, man, I hope he's not going to take that as a diss. Because I look at him like he's way up here. So the purpose to pimp the pen and reverse the conditions I'm living in and do bigger numbers than Eminem. Like, I want to be as famous as him or right. sell as many records as him. He took it like a compliment, man. And he was like rapping. I was like, wow, I was blown away. Then I was like totally logged on to the idea of, oh my God, I did a song with this dude that's one of the, you know, touted as one of the greatest, you know, rappers to ever live, you know?
Yeah, that's so crazy. I had heard that Tech was not into the idea of the continuing the Chopper series.
Over his career, Tech N9ne has had a series of songs with prominent guest appearances, with all the artists using the fast-rapping Midwest style known as chopping. It has come to be known as the Chopper series. It includes Tech's 2007 song Midwest Choppers, Midwest Choppers 2, Worldwide Choppers, and the Chris and Eminem collaboration discussed in this episode, Speed'em WWC 2.
And it said almost jokingly that he wouldn't continue it unless it had Jay-Z or Eminem on it.
Right.
Is that true?
Yes.
Wow.
He did. He didn't want to do any more choppers, but he ended up doing them.
Well, I guess if you set a goal that high.
Yeah, and he's achieved that. He's, you know, and
gonna get a circa 95 era Jay-Z backed.
Yeah, man. What now? With so many brothers fighting, it's harder to take to Y. B, well, check out the J, check out the A, check out the Y, Z. I don't think Jay-Z's out of the question. I know Tech has talked about trying to get him on stuff, so.
Wow.
We'll see.
Get him spitting that that double time stuff he used to do with Kane.
Yeah, back in the day. Yeah. I was just watching some of that recently, and I was like, I wonder can he chop? And then I just saw that recently. Like, man, he came out as a chopper.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. He's doing the fast rap thing before the first album a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have this kind of group in quotes amongst the Strange Music crew, the 816 Boys, right? That's you.
Right.
And Tech and Cut Calhoun and your cousin
Maxzilla. Yeah.
And so it seems like the only songs you do as the 816 Boys are kind of these goofy, over the top party songs. 816 Boys. Okay. 816 Boys. Okay. Are you really going to say that, buddy? We get money over here. How did that happen?
It was a joke. It was originally jokes. We weren't originally going to do that. We were like, we weren't going to do anything serious. You know, it was just like, oh, hey, man, let's do this song. Because Tech was like, it's going to do a song called Areola. Hey, Areola, stick them out. Don't know what I'm talking about. That circle around a skittle in the middle you put in your mouth. But I love you, baby. Hell no. Titties, if they're big or small, that's what I'm talking about. That turn around and pull them out your bra. And it's funny because that was a joke, but that's one of our biggest songs. We do that and the crowd goes bananas. So I don't know, man. I think we were being funny and it caught on. Sometimes that happens. I remember Cisco from Drew Hill talking about the thong song was a joke and it ended up being one of their biggest hits.
Right.
Or his biggest hits.
Maybe. Yeah. So you and Tech have been touring together for a long time, been close for a long time. There was a period where he was doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
And you were often the person who had to even at times physically grab them from his hand.
Yeah.
What kind of effect did that have on your relationship, like as that period was happening?
That probably made us more brothers. I can remember somebody gave him a, some wet, a dipstick, you know, where they dipped a cigarette in formaldehyde. A dude gave that to him and I snatched it out of his hand, not knowing that was soaked through your skin. And I ended up being high, and I'm really sensitive to drugs. I ended up being high from crushing that up in my hand. You know what I mean? And I was like really, really pissed at him for that. Yeah, I was really, really mad at him for, you know, I used to tell him he's going to kill us, man. He took 15 X pills in one night, ecstasy pills in one night. I'm like, you're going to kill us, man. We're on our way to doing something great. You told me, man, that it's okay for me to lose my job and that we can make it. You know what I'm saying? And then I got married and then had a kid. And now I got this family I got to take care of, man. You're going to kill us on these drugs, you know? And then he just stopped on his own.
Yeah.
Then also he moved in with me and my wife and my kid. And so I could keep an eye on him at that point.
Really? That was the impetus to him doing that?
No, that just happened to occur.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I could keep an eye on him and keep him. I've always been really protective of Tech. I've always been very overprotective. Matter of fact, he just said something the other day. I said something to him and he's like, he left on our off day and went way out somewhere on the beach or something. And he called me. He's like 30 minutes away. And he called me and woke me up. hey, man, I'm just letting you know I'm like 30 minutes away at the beach. I was like, who's with you? Security with you? He said, no. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, Chris, man, you're not going to be able to protect me my whole life. I'm out here chilling. And you're way over there. I'll tell you what. Come on to the beach. You want to protect me that bad, then you just come here.
Oh.
But I didn't. I was like, man, I'm too tired to deal with you today. Goodbye.
Yeah. One other thing about you in tech that I wanted to know is I read you guys used to argue over which shoes to wear on stage.
We still...
Have you found the definitive kind of shoe that like looks good and is comfortable? Or?
No, because he wants looks good and I want comfortable because we're athletes up there. So we do. We have a couple of times found the perfect. The shoes we wear now, we always typically wear Jordans. But, you know, there's been a couple that are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we have now work, but they're low tops. And I'm like, man, I put a special little orthotic in my shoe. So I need I need a really good shoe. So we try to find it to be functional and fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
So he tries to, he's like, man, I think you can even work with these. He tries to get ones that he thinks are comfortable for me. So we meet in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, something about the fan base of Strange. I was reading an old interview you did. You said, I would have to say the white fans generally want to see Wild and Crazy.
Uh-huh.
And the black fans typically like to see if you look like the last dude they really liked. Do you yeah. think in the intervening years anything has changed kind of from either side?
No. Yeah. I think that the white fans, they like the trap and hood music now. But I think that primarily black fans typically like something that they identify with more. You know, that like just like the last guy that who had this song that they like, if this dude is like him. This is just an observation I've made. I think that the black fans see that and they're like, oh yeah, that's like so-and-so. So they identify with it. So they go ahead and log on to that dude. Where I think with the white side of our fan base or any fan base, they're generally a bit more adventurous. They want to see Wild and Crazy. They want to see, you know, me with a big blonde afro. Where in the black community, they were like, man, these dudes are weird.
Mm.
But now everybody's dying their hair blonde because of Odell Beckham Jr. now. So now everybody's got blonde hair. And I'm like, see, man, I was
ahead of the curve.
I was like 8 years early.
Yeah, yeah.
8 years too early.
Yeah. And you are such a key part of the Strange music sound, you know, in the early years. Basically every record that came out of there would have your hand on it, whether literally your voice or in writing or whatever. The label, you know, is adding a bunch of new acts, getting into new genres, things like that. Are you still the glue of the label? Do you still feel like it's not a Strange music release unless you're involved in some way?
I feel like that. I don't know if everybody feels like that, but I feel like that. Like it has to have it's like official with the Strange fans if Chris Calico's on that album. You know, and I'm typically on at least one song on. I don't know. I haven't been on the last one or two Mayday releases. Even like Mackenzie Nicole, who's one of the newer acts, pop acts.
Right, he's a pop artist, yeah.
Well, I co-wrote her song, Acting Like You Know.
You're acting like you know.
She wrote it, and then I came in and just changed some stuff and changed her melodies because I felt like, no, this is how a hit is formulated. You want a pop hit, you got to do it like this. You know, because she's new. So, you know, she's just getting her feet wet. So a lot of, I feel like, especially the Tech N9ne releases aren't, if I'm not on them, it's not official.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, all sixes and sevens, I was touring, and I wasn't on that as much, and I see a lot of fans comment about that. Like, man, Chris is not on this. What's up? It really wasn't any reason why that happened. It was just, I was touring. It wasn't any bad reason.
So one of the most unique things about your voice is the way you'll use different inflections, different tones, both, you know, singing and I think especially rapping. Sometimes even in the same verse, you'll use two or three different voices. What kinds of things are you thinking about? What kinds of decisions are you making when you decide which of your many voices to use at any given moment?
Man, I have no idea. I just do it. Like, I'll write it, and I'll say, okay, I'm going to sing this part. And I'm going to rap this part. A lot of times, I don't come up with what voice I'm going to use until I'm in the booth. So if I started off like, I spent so many that I did that. Strange Music Box. When I wrote it, I just wrote, see, once they open my lid, I'm going to give it to them. Ever since I was a little bit of kid, I've been truly brewing. But then when I got in the booth, I was like, it feels way more exciting if I say, see, once they open my lid, I'm going to give it to them. Ever since I was a little bit of kid, I've been truly brewing.
I'm reflecting on what I did before I ran into them. I used to be a fat jerk, now I flirt because the sin of a woman. Now I don't act like, walk like.
It felt like I was more exciting. It was more entertaining to use these different voice inflections, you know what I'm saying? So I just, you know, I just kind of, dude, I literally just kind of freestyle those parts. Like, what will grab the attention, especially if it's, you know, Tech and somebody else rapping, like a Ritz or Seth Crew, these dudes that really, really rap. You know, I'm like, man, how can I smash these dudes? Because we're in friendly competition there.
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so we...
especially as you do all those albums of compilations and ciphers and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
And these dudes are elite MCs there. So I'm like, man, how can I smash on these dudes? Even when we did the first Midwest Choppers, he had these two dudes, D-Loke and Dilemma, on that song. And, you know, I noticed that everybody was, even Tech, was like, I'm not gonna.
Welcome to misery, where the killers pop it off. And when I say pop it off, I mean deadly with the tongue of the gun. We can do it
different. And the other dudes, they were just like, back. And I was like, how can I outshine everybody? Oh, I'm going to sing my verse. So I was like, I wrote it chopping, and I came on it singing. Kelly, baby, you better act right, get right. I'm a fast nigga hooking up with the fastest badass. And he hit you with the lyrical, miracle web. Incredible, about to knock the head with the several. Diggy down, watch the picky pound. Let the clown.
And if you look up at the sound, you can be found by the nigga forming the crown. Are you really mean?
I knew if I did it like that, it would stick way out, and it did.
Yeah.
And everybody remembered my verse.
I noticed that you just now, obviously people can't see this, but you were doing the thing that I've seen, you know, Eminem and other fast rappers do, almost like counting syllables, counting 16th notes on your fingers while you're rapping.
Yeah, it's like it helps you, I don't know, it helps you get the right cadence out. Like I do, I move my hands in this weird motion. Like if you ever see any videos, it's like a windmill kind of. So I'm not necessarily counting, but I'm like moving it in a way that it keeps me on. My first engineer, Rob Rebeck, used to say I'd be popping and locking. Even when I have the girls like sing background on my music, I like do certain little movements, like swell my hands up, like sweep my hands up to make them say, ah. You know what I'm saying? Or something like that. It makes them really use the cadence I want or use the voice inflection that I want by moving in a certain way, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you'll see a lot of people do that.
Yeah. Speaking of backing vocals, there is a fair amount of them on Go on the new album. Who arranged all the backing vocals?
Me.
Yeah?
Everything. I wrote everything. I arranged everything. Now, Michael Seven Summers produced everything except for Didn't Want to Wake You, and that was produced by Young Fire. But usually if Seven's doing the beats or he and I come up with the beat together, like my single Talk Upon It, I had an idea for the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tell him, and actually the first beat he gave me was horrible. And I was like, no, that's not it. And then the second beat he gave me was right on point.
I leave love up to someone else, but I'll make you feel a lifetime. In 1 minute, you can stand it by yourself.
But yeah, I'll arrange those. I'll arrange the background. I write all the parts for the girls to come and sing. And it's my wife, Crystal, and her artist, Delinea Janelle, and then another girl named Gina McFadden, who was from a very famous musical family.
I was going to say from the last name, from McFadden and Whitehead.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, McFadden is her daddy. Yeah, Lonnie McFadden is her father. And so she sings background for me and stuff. She wants to be an artist. She wants to be an artist on Strange Music. We haven't ever had a female, so I'm not sure if that may happen or good now. I don't know. But they sound great on my records, man. They did. And really, Gina works a job. So, and my wife runs a business that we have, that we're partners in. And then Delinia, she has she does real estate. So they're freed up to come to the studio anytime. So not anytime, but they're more they have more liberal schedule than Gina. So I just have them come and I teach them the parts like on the spot. Like I don't usually tell them what they're doing before they get there. So they get there and I'm like, okay, so you're gonna sing this right? Logged off. Are you gonna do ba 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 ba? You know, and I'll just teach them when they get there.
Nice. And Out of Line on Go has you doing your best kind of Prince Rick James style thing.
You know, it's funny. It just ends up being like that. I was really just trying to make some 80s funk. Mm. I wasn't concentrating on Prince or Rick James, but sometimes when I sing like that, it sounds like Rick James.
I was going to say, I think about midway through the song, it definitely starts to sound a little bit in his style.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm influenced by all of those dudes, man, by all everything from the 80s. Now, the beat definitely feels like that Minneapolis sound of the time or whatever, but I wasn't necessarily hunting for a Prince sound. I just wanted it to feel like 80s because everybody was doing that in the 80s. You know, everybody was using those synths like that. Prince is probably the most well known for it, but I wasn't shooting for Prince's sound. I was just shooting for that 80s and trying to put my new futuristic spin on it.
Yeah. And, you know, Didn't Want to Wake You is, you know, real emotional kind of centerpiece of the album.
Right. You know, happens
maybe a quarter of the way through, but really like real powerful tune. It does this thing where lyrically, you know, it's very full of pain, very expressive, but musically has a...
It's bright.
Bright, yeah, exactly. Yeah. How can you do that without it feeling like discordant? You know what I mean? Without it feeling like, what's going on here? This doesn't make sense.
I don't think I think that deeply about it, man. I think I just, when I heard that, that's the first thing I heard. I was in the living room with my son playing the video game and he fell asleep and I was listening to that beat and I just thought, what we are is what we are. And I was like, man, how do I write a song around that? Now, what is that? What does that even mean? And I thought, man, whatever we feel is, what we feel is what we feel, because it's truly it. You know, I'm very truthful about, I'm probably a little too truthful in my music, and guy code wise, I'm probably a little too truthful with my wife. And tell her how dudes think, and this is what we feel, and, you know. But truly, that's what we think. That's what we feel. That's how we are. So if you're not saying it, you're just being deceptive, and it's hard for me to be deceptive.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So I just painted that picture on there, and again, that's something that I mixed other people's relationship, my relationship. I just, you know, just things that I've observed about relationships in with that song.
Yeah, and. The way you sequenced Go, the songs run directly into each other, you know, no breaks at all. Why?
I always do that. I always do that, man. I like it to feel like a DJ's mixing something. You know what I'm saying? Mixing the songs together. I like it to flow, one flow right into the other, right into the next, right into the next.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just like it to feel like a full body of work. I like it to feel very cohesive.
Mm.
You know, so I've actually done that on every album. But I don't know. It feels like... The songs feel more glued together on this one, though.
And Wallflower, I was curious about, because there's a moment in it where you imagine kids you grew up with, now adults, kind of being like, hey, remember Tech and Chris?
Uh-huh.
Hey, they're big successes now. That's crazy.
Closed out, all of them get that synonym. Do you remember them two squares in school? You know, Aaron and Chris, now they blew up the rapping with them and them.
Oh, yeah, I remember them.
Both of you really do live in your hometown and have the potential to actually run into people like that or hear that so-and-so was saying stuff like that. What is it like living, you know, still living in your hometown and actually having interaction with folks like that?
I like it, man. I actually live in my old neighborhood. I bought a house in my neighborhood that I grew up in. So I actually live right there now.
Wow. So that wasn't imagined, that kind of, you know.
Nah, man.
I heard so-and-so was amazed that.
Yeah, man. Nah.
These guys.
I bump into people all the time, but I think that was his take on it. I think people felt like I was going to do something big.
Mm-hmm.
I just always been a pretty charismatic kid. I always sang. I always danced. You know, I was always very outspoken, you know, and things like that. So I don't think it was unexpected with kids that grew up with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I run into them and they're happy for me. So it's always a joyous occasion. When I run into people that, you know, that I even didn't like in school or I had fights with or whatever, you know, it's always like, Chris, every time I see him, you know. It's a good thing is my answer.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought of this particularly on Happy-ish, but I think it's true throughout the record. You are, you know, obviously singing on this album a lot more than rapping.
I live inside the darkest cloud. I could never see me smiling. If I don't make it out of the woods, I live in limbo. See, I'm not happy. I'm just happy-ish. Get everybody on some happy shit.
Can you talk about some of the differences of writing song lyrics to be sung, as opposed to rap lyrics?
Well, the rap lyrics is a lot more because we're known for our rapid fire, so it takes five times as long to write those songs. And then we have to change up, you know, we change our patterns up with every two bars. You know what I'm saying? So if I say, nobody can catch me, Speedy Gonzalez, it ain't the problem. If you got the beat, nobody gonna have to beat it up out of them. I switch. It's a lot of them, and I'm in a lot of them. Me and Nene used to follow them. I got the out of the body, and I change it again. This is it, man. A hit man. A hit man. Karate. Hit fans. Lip hands. Hit dance. Now the lick hands. Is advanced. Is this stand the proud of them? Who stands with two hands up? Move in the crowd of them. If I ain't make a sense, you then stand for the amp. That be like a bass. It ain't never been a gift. I'm in a heat. I'm a beat. I'm a burn. You know, so I keep moving. I keep switching those patterns. That's what makes us stand out to other even fast rappers. Because a lot of fast rappers out here, and they just, I'm never impressed by that.
Right.
But when you can move an if, I ain't making sense to get the sample, the imp, that like a bass. It had never been a gift for me to heat them up, beat them up, burn them. Then I let them out. They never heard of us and look at them turning up. I slapped the short off a super simple to make them an impotent infant. Wouldn't I be flipping niggas be feminine? So the purpose to pimp the pen and reverse it. When I hear them doing that, that's like impressive. So I think, how can I impress the best MCs? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's my goal. But then I also want to impress the singers. And I also want to impress the fans that are just fans of those two different things. I don't know. It feels like easy to me to transition in between both of those.
Mm-hmm.
It feels easy to me to write singing songs and a rap song. Like, neither one of those are hard to me. Like, this is kind of second nature to me, man. This is what I do. You know, I mean, I've said I was quitting a million times, but this is what I am. You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, I wouldn't be sacrificing having time and my kids crying and, you know, missing their father and me missing time raising them. You know, I wouldn't do that. I would go just work a regular job, but I can't because I'm this.
And Big FU on the album, yeah. Right? Very, like, to my ear, kind of stacks sort of feel to it.
What am I to do? You can't help me. It's a Big FU.
What is it about that kind of late 60s, early 70s R&B Memphis sound that you like?
Well, I listen to everything, man. I listen to country. I listen to classics. I listen to metal, man. I listen to, you know, everything from Johnny Cash to Young Thug. You know what I'm saying? So, well, not necessarily Young Thug, but probably more Rich Homie Quan.
Mm-hmm.
So I may have on a Doors song, or I may have on System of a Down, and I may have on Luke Bryan, or I may have, you know what I mean? I listen to all these different genres of music, man. And actually Seven, my producer, he just had the guitar riff.
My wish for it, more stays the same.
And he was just playing the guitar. He said, man, well, you think you could do a song like this? Just based around this guitar? I got an idea. And I was like, yeah. He's like, what would you do? And I was like, what puts me in the mind of Ray Charles' song, Lonely Avenue? Because it kind of moved like that. Teeth is just like lamps. My pillow is just like stars.
Well, I toss and turn so every night. I'm not used to being alone.
Which, by the way, my mother sang to me every night to put me to sleep. My mother has been a singer in her whole life, too. But she never sang lullabies, rock my baby, and she never sang those kind of things. She would sing that. I toss and turn, so every night it's all, and it's all because of you. She would sing that to sing me to sleep with that. So when he was playing that, it moved like it. So I'm like, dang, I need to write something bluesy like that. And I just wrote exactly how I was feeling like, you know what I'm saying? I thought about it, and I was kind of in a mood at that time. So I was writing it. I don't ever see anyone of us changing. The more I wish for, the more stays the same. You know, that's what I felt. You know what I mean? And it ended up, it does. It feels like Stacks.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Amazing. No doubt.
And, you know, before the interview started, we were talking a little bit. You were talking a little bit about Stop the World and some of the response to it.
Now my life is like a merry-go-round, sick and ready to stop now. And I can't handle this speed. Stop the world and let me off.
I know that song came out of a very difficult time for you.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that, about the period that led up to you writing it?
Man, I've had a lot of those difficult times, man. I have those periods a lot, man. You know, I've been diagnosed with all these different things, which nobody really knows. There's no scientific proof of bipolarism or any of these things, man. They're diagnosing it based on the symptoms.
Right.
We all go through ups and downs. I've had periods of depression. I've had periods of anxiety because of trauma in my life. And actually, I have a chemical imbalance. Like my chemical, I actually went to a place called KU Integrative Medicine. And they measured my dopamine, my norepinephrine, my serotonin, which they're off the charts low. Like, how are you even functioning as a normal person low? But, you know, I just have to make it, man. I'm a winner. I'm a survivor. You know, I know it sounds real cliche-ish, you know, but I am, man. You know, I've overcome a lot of things. I've overcome being a fat dude with vitiligo and getting thousands of kids to listen to my music and loving me in spite of that. You know what I'm saying? And so I get to these dark points sometimes, man, you know, and I felt like I just want to stop hurting. You know, I go through these things, you know. I've been hearing a lot more people talk about this. I heard Ronda Rousey talk about when she lost, how she felt suicidal because she felt like, who was she without being a champion?
I was like in the medical room, and I was like down in the corner, I was sitting in the corner, and I was like, what am I anymore if I'm not this? And I was literally sitting there and like thinking about killing myself, and that exact second I'm like, I'm nothing. I'm like, what do I do anymore? And no one gives a shit about me anymore without this. And
you know, I've heard just several celebrities recently talk about it, because now I feel like it's okay to do this, you know? And so, you know, I've always talked about it since the very beginning with anxiety on my first album.
Something really fucked up going on inside of me. Can't believe that hold it got on me. It gotta be temporary, because the shit I feel is very scary. I think little pills is necessary, because I can't tell what I...
You know, and so the byproduct of writing a song like that is that people are touched by it and people identify with it. You know, there's millions and millions of people with anxiety problems. There's millions and millions of people with depression. That's why these pharmaceutical companies can get super wealthy off of treating these people. You know what I'm saying? And so I write about it, and I don't mind. I feel like it's brave, and I talk about things that people don't want to talk about on my serious songs. And then everybody who hears it identifies with it. And I, you know, most of the comments on Stop the World video are like, I was going to commit suicide, or thank you, I lost my mother, or, you know, it's something. I cried. I mean, a lot of guys on there talking about, they cried, you know, and it's really touched people, but that's a byproduct of it. Me, it's my therapy. to be able to get these feelings out in song form.
And finally, GO, the title of your album, is actually an acronym, right?
Yeah.
What is that and where did it come from?
It's Tech N9ne named it, man. It stands for God's Order, really. And, you know, we didn't put it on the cover because we didn't want people to think it was a gospel album. But he said, man, I feel like, man, you're supposed to be this guy. You know, you're supposed to be a star, man. You're a big, you know, we did a showcase, the showcase that we did in Kansas City that you came to. And he was like, man, when I saw you on the stage, I'm like, man, some people look at you as my hype man. Some people look at you as a singer. Some people look at you as a rapper. When I saw you on that stage, I was like, this dude's a effing star. He's like, man, you are such a superstar, dude. We got to do what we got to do to get you there. It's Strange Music, man. Whatever we can do, man, we got to do whatever we got to do to get you to superstardom, because I think that's what you are, man. And people need to hear these big records that you have, and people need to hear your message too, man. It's worthy of the world's ear.
And one last thing I have to ask, since, you know, you have a fantastic solo career, but also are such a great support to Tech N9ne on stage, who is your favorite hype man who's not you?
Flavor Flav.
Why?
Flavor Flav is the best hype man ever to live.
Yeah, boy!
Who's a better hype man than Flav, man? He killed it. He killed it. I'm going to tell you what, man. We got him on the phone about a year or two ago. And he said, man, tell the Chris Calico dude, man, I see him. I see him on the hype man game, baby. I see him. I was like, wow. For him to know, I didn't think he even knew who I was. For him to know me and admire what I do when I'm taking, you know, notes from him as a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So got to be Flav.
Amazing. All right. Well, Chris, thanks so much for coming by, man.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me, man.
As Chris mentions towards the end of the interview, I got a chance to see him perform a few tracks from GO a little while back in Kansas City. I was blown away that someone who up to that point I had only seen as a hype man was commanding a large band and singing great R&B songs. That was my first clue as to Chris's versatility, something I got a much larger scope of while preparing for this interview. One thing I especially loved about this conversation was getting to hear Chris sing and rap so much while discussing his music. His enthusiasm and his talent showed up loud and clear in those sections. And make sure to check out GO. Both Josh and I have been stuck on several of its songs while putting this episode together. Join us next week when our guest will be super producer Dame Grease. Dame is best known for his work with DMX. He did almost all of X's debut album, It's Dark and Hell is Hot. He's also done iconic hits for The Lox, Freeway, Nas, Noriega, Max B, and many more. We'll talk his early history with Rough Riders, the details of his distinct production style, the real story behind We'll Always Love Big Papa, and a whole lot more. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and you can help us out with as little as $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
All of the medications that they were saying he was on at the time of his death, I've been on all of those medications.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I wouldn't do that. I would go just work a regular job, but I can't because I'm this.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I remember being scared to death when I heard that. Like, oh my God, people, man, how are they able to say this on record?
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I worked at T-Mobile.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
It was not for me, and I was scared the whole time I was trying to do this.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Saad Mukhtar.
And then I had vitiligo on my face, too.
Special thanks to Michelle McDevitt and the whole crew at Audible Treats.
And they loved it because we're kind of the outcast of the world, too.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Yeah, man. Those are good. You did your homework. Hi, see?
All right. A little lint remover.
Yeah, see?
The microphone here.
You stay ready. You don't have to get ready.
Nice.